The following is a Super Network production with Super Marcy.
Look, as much as I love that we don't really see images of that film, I just want to see that film.
The terrible Australian Bea Jermaine.
If they made a romantic comedy out of The Fly, this would probably be it.
It contains coarse language.
After it was over and the credits were done, my friend just looked at me and he just said, "Dude, that was f***."
Mature themes.
Her husband wants her need satisfied and she had a zombie baby with him.
Potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Please find us at supermarcy.com and subscribe to us via Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy.
G'day everyone, this is Bea Jermaine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to the long-awaited 10th episode of Podcasters the Horror, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I do a retrospective series on the short-lived 2000s anthology horror TV show, Masters of Horror. And with me as always is, of course, my co-host, Super Marcy. Hello Marcy, how are you?
Hey, hey, doing all right. Just melting in the Melbourne heat, but other than that, doing good. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. I had quite the busy week. Had some family down visiting because it was my niece's baptism over the weekend. So my mum and dad and older brother came down for that. And as you would expect with family, it was a fun but very busy couple of days. But it was good though. It was like nice to kind of catch up with the parents and just sort of spend quality time with everyone. And of course they were just excited just to come down here and see their grandchildren, of course. Yeah. But other than that, things have been good, Marcy. enjoying the fact that we're finally getting around to doing episode of Podcasters, which we haven't done, I think, since early October was the last episode we did. So it has been a while.
I think life just happened because between this last episode, we sort of in Victoria, we came out of lockdown and then, everything just went a bit crazy and things got busy and then we had Christmas, New Year, and we've had to play catch up with all the other podcasts, but we are back. We're making it work.
Hey, Dana, we're almost at the tail end of this journey on Masters of Horror. And because I think with tonight's two episodes we're going to be talking about, I believe there's only six left that we're talking about. So I think it is six. I could be completely wrong. So it's probably eight. I'm probably getting all these things wrong.
No, you're correct. It is six. And of course, once we wrap up season two, we will be doing we're still continuing Podcasters of Horror, but we will go into doing some horror anthology films and Fear Itself, which is like the continuation of Masters of Horror in a way. Yep. It was on
I believe here in Australia it aired on FX here in Australia, but
something like that. But yeah, it was on because Showtime didn't renew for a third season. It moved elsewhere for that one. So once we finish this, we'll be moving on to some horror anthology films and Fear Itself, and then beyond that, just have to keep listening.
Indeed. Well, we'll have a lot of interesting stuff to talk about, but before we get to tonight's episode, Marcy, we have a very special guest for this episode.
Yes, we do. Very excited.
Indeed. And it's a guy who was on a previous episode of Podcasters Horror all the way back when we discussed the season one finale, Imprint, and as well as the season two opener, The Damn Thing. And that, of course, is Mr. Chris Barnes. Hello, Chris.
G'day, guys. How you doing? Thanks for having me again.
Oh, not too bad. It's always fun when you're on, Chris, and this is only your second time ever on a podcast. but we knew we had to bring you back because you, like Marcy and I, you definitely have watched Masters of Horror throughout the years. So it's always good to actually find somebody else out there who actually has seen the show and discuss it as well in depth.
For sure, and I think I feel privileged that this is also the second episode I'm on, because the first episode, Imprint, being my favourite out of the two seasons, Pelts being one of the episodes we're discussing today, is my second favourite. So, yeah, I am more than privileged to be joining to discuss two of these fantastic efforts.
Indeed.
I am curious to hear your thoughts on Pelts. But, yeah, B, do you want to give us the rundown of Pelts before we start?
And we're not supposed to go out there, are we? I mean, maybe there's a reason people don't go this deep into the woods.
Mother Maida has done a good job spreading stories for generations. To scare people off the land. Bunch of crap. The stories don't scare me.
Many years ago, a whole nest of the pine lights gathered deep in the woods. They became sentinels of the lost city. It's why I warn people about trespassing.
Belts like these, we can have anything our hearts desire. This time next week, Lou, we're gonna have one of the world's most extraordinary fur coats. It's gonna make me a very rich man, and you'd like that, wouldn't you, Shanna?
It's like it's cursed or something.
I don't believe in curses, Lou.
Not finished with you yet.
Indeed. The episode, of course, is Pelts, which is directed by Dario Argento of Suspiria, Tenebra, and Trauma fame. And the screenplay was written by Matt Van Hoos. Had quite an interesting career as a screenwriter, having written White Noise 2, The Light, Fright Night 2, and as well as the Stephen King miniseries Bag of Bones, which we will talk about in a future episode of The King Zone. And it's based on a short story by F. Paul Wilson. And it also stars Meatloaf, John Saxon, and Ellen Yuizzi. I probably butchered her last name, so please forgive me. And the plot summary for this episode is, fur trader Jack Feldman knows that you cannot make a coat without breaking a few animals' necks. In this pursuit to make the perfect fur coat to win over a woman, Feldman steals supernatural raccoon pelts that violently turn against those that covet them. Now, Chris, as you've just stated before that Pelts is your second favourite Masters of Horror episode, please tell us your thoughts on the episode.
Sure. I mean, just reading, listening to that synopsis, I mean, what's not to like? It's it's quite the premise.
It is.
And yeah, and Meatloaf in the lead role, I was impressed by how much of a scumbag he was.
He really was.
Everything really leans into this entirely kind of manic, batshit mood that elevated from Dario Argento's previous Masters of Horror effort, like Jennifer. Jennifer, I found at the time, was pretty full on, but Pelts took it to another level and really amped up that intensity. And I found that the practical effects, the gore, was also extremely well pulled off. There's a particular effect in there where I think there's a raccoon trap or some type of animal trap that's set off. I can't believe that like got on television. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
So I just embraced the insanity, really. It was a really fun. Oh, fun may not be the right word. It was a really interesting time.
It definitely was. Now, Marcy, this is your first time watching Pelts, but you and I were had a lot to say about the previous Dario Argento episode of Masters of Horror, Jennifer, back a few episodes back. But tell us your thoughts on Pelts and how does it compare to Dario Argento's first effort for the series?
Yeah, look, Jennifer is a weird one, and we had that discussion on that episode, and, you know, I was just basically sitting there trying to decipher what the fuck it's all meant to mean. And it is so gross, but yeah. It's definitely a weird one. This one is also really, really freaking weird. But there is sort of like a weird manic feel about Pelts. And as we watched it together, and there are a lot of very sort of like giallo elements to it, with the visuals, the color, and the music that really doesn't suit any scene that it's used in. It has this weird like dreamlike essence to it, which that I liked about it, as well as that it looked really good. It had a lot of very vibrant colors, and like visually it's done really, really well. But I don't know, something just didn't quite mesh with me. And I think it does have to do with that this is really just manic, because I'm sitting there going, who the fuck acts like this? This is just, this is not realistic in the slightest. And, you know, look, I am someone who loves animals. I freaking love raccoons. I would have all those trash pandas as pets if I could. So the bit of violence, obviously it's not real violence, but I did not want to see that. I know it's not real, it's not Cannibal Holocaust, but I just, I didn't like that.
That aspect's pretty interesting, because I was wondering whether Dario Argento was trying to, you know, make some commentary on fashion and fur and all that type of...
I believe definitely there is something to say, because you sort of... It does take you behind that curtain of, you know, this is what happens for you to get leather, fur, all these kinds of things. And that, you know, it's very brutal. It's you know, I would liken it to, you know, the videos you see of, like, you know, animals getting ready for slaughter for your meat. Something like that. And I just felt like, geez, you know what? I feel like Peter would fucking love Pelts with it. But,
true,
you know,
it kind of fits into their style, doesn't it?
Yeah. But it, for me, it's just very, very weird. I'm still very mixed on it, even though there's a lot of things that I did like, and as well as things I didn't really like. But I'm with you that the gore and effects are really, really well done. And there are some things you're like, how the fuck did this make it to TV, mate? Especially towards the end, with what Meatloaf does to himself. And I'm like, this is just taking what happened in Martyrs one step too far. Because it's self-inflicted. But I also could not help but think of The Simpsons with see my vest, made from my real hairy chest. That would be Meatloaf singing that. But it is a very weird one, but it sort definitely has a message there. And, you know, it can be hard to really sort of get into that message with how crazy it is, but there is a scene with Mother Mater, who is a very weird character that shows up. And she sort of expresses, you're doing this for your own vanities. And I'm like, that's what the movie's trying to get at. The horrible ness of being so vain and using things to, you know, get what you want. So there is that in there. But Abid, how do you feel about pelts?
Well, I'll say this, Marcy. Like, I think in comparison, like, rewatching this again and also having rewatched, you know, Jennifer, like, a few episodes back, it's interesting, like, I've always kind of felt like, for the longest time, I felt Jennifer was better than Pelts, but now having sort of rewatched two recently, but I mean, both these episodes recently as part of this show, I can definitely say that Pelts is definitely a much stronger episode than Jennifer in a lot of ways, but I do agree it is kind of a mixed bag in both the best and worst way. It is a very manic episode, like it is legit all over the place. But I think at the same time, though, I think the only way that this episode works is you have to view this as a comedy. There is no way that you can take anything that is happening in this entire episode seriously, because there are moments where I think when you and I were watching it, Marcy, over Discord, like, there were moments I legit laughed out loud. Like, the scene where Meatloaf is chasing the character of, I believe it's Sana, played by Ellen Yuzi. Again, if I butchered her last name, please forgive me. Like, the way he chases up after her and she gets stuck in the elevator and he legit opens up, like, the elevator door and flings himself down. I was, like, pissing myself laughing, because it feels like something out of a parody. And it's weird, though, because, like, Dario Argento, like, his tone can sometimes be all over the place. Like, there can, like, even if he's playing something dead serious, it just comes off as more comical in execution. And I couldn't help but feel that quite a number of times during this episode. And I also think that, at least compared to Jennifer, like, I talked about on the episode with Jennifer how I felt, like, visually that felt muted for Dario Argento.
Big time.
But here, he just went all out with the visual style. There's a lot more color, a lot of reds and purples. Yeah. Like, the kind of style you would see in something like Suspiria and some of his other work. And I appreciate that aspect is in this episode. And also, like, Meatloaf is so over the top in this in this episode that, yeah, it's not a good performance, but you can't help but be entertained by it, because it kind of reflects the kind of the manic nature of the whole episode. And of course, the gore is incredibly brutal and violent, and I just like how basically all these sort of suicides that pretty much anyone who comes in contact with these pelts pretty much inflict them in the most over the top ways. Like, we, like you already mentioned before, like the guy who pretty much bear traps his own face off. But then you have a nut like one of the workers at a Meatloaf shop who legit, instead of like suffocating herself, she like sews her mouth and nose and everything shut so she can suffocate. And then of course you got the dude who was like cutting the fur, and then he like cuts open his own stomach and pulls out his own guts and everything, and it's incredibly gory. And it's, again,
I like the aspect though that with their sort of self mutilation, self suicide, whatever you want to call it, like each act reflects what they do. So with the young dude that takes the baseball bat to the other character sort of reflects part of an earlier scene, and then when he uses the bear trap thing, that reflects when they trapped all the raccoons, and like the lady who sews herself, she's one of the sewers, and the guy was cutting, you know, the pelt with the scissors, so he uses the scissors. Like, all that stuff just, it reflects, like, something they did with the pelt. And I liked that, but as you said, it is so fucking over the top. But visually, it's very striking. As hard as it is to watch, where she sews, like, her face basically shut. Like, that felt like it was straight out of Imprint. And they even showed, I think, Imprint in this or the next one.
I think it was the next one, but it definitely was like Dario Argento probably thought, oh, well, you thought what I did with Jennifer was gory. You ain't seen nothing yet. But
Really, it revels in its despicableness, really. That's what, and that's what I probably enjoyed a lot about it is that, it enjoyed itself. I felt that from it. You know, you're talking about how it's over the top, and, you know, Meatloaf certainly is playing the ham. But I think it was done, you know, in a really like self-aware manner, I thought, particularly for Dario Argento, because a lot of his later works don't kind of have that sense at all. It almost feels like he's fumbling his way through them. But in Pelts, I just thought it knew exactly what it was and what it wanted to do to its audience. And the other really positive thing I'd say about it is something that you've both alluded to already. It's just the visual style. Something I struggled with a number of episodes in rewatching Masters of Horror recently is just the production values that had this real kind of made-for-TV sheen. But Imprint, like you mentioned, and Pelts, I thought, were probably top tier in terms of their cinematic quality. And really, I quite enjoy, you know, those dark reds and the shadows that were really quite prominent in this piece.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Like, it's one of those episodes that is definitely for me, like, I would if I did a top five of the most visually stylish episodes on Masters of Horror, Pelts would definitely be up there, for sure. And one thing, again, like what you already talked about, the score. I kind of like the score due to how all over the place it is, and it did remind me so much of scores from Italian horror films from the 70s and 80s, because that was one of the things I love about Italian horror, is that the score never reflects what's happening on screen. Like, you watch something like Cannibal Holocaust, and it has, like, this, like, beautiful kind of almost a lullaby music, and it's in contrast with all the carnage that's happening on screen. And but that's the thing I think makes that works about this episode, is the manic, all over the place nature it is. But one aspect I do want to talk about, and I think this needs to be discussed, is, of course, the relationship between Feldman and Sana, which is just absolutely bizarre.
Yeah, I don't... I just can't. Like, you know, Feldman is... Like, she calls him a pig. And I don't want to insult pigs, but yeah, this character is fucking disgusting. Like, literally, you can smell the disgust coming out. But he, like, clearly doesn't respect women or boundaries, and he's just obsessed with this chick, and she just doesn't want a bar of him. So it does go into, weird places, but,
Yeah, and also, like, it's... Like, yeah, she doesn't want a bar of him, and then, like, 2 seconds later, it's like she's like, oh, hello, and stuff like that. And, like, I just don't get this relationship. It is just so weird. But again, it kind of reflects the kind of the nature of this whole episode. Like, it is just changes itself on a dime, just like that. And it is just bizarre.
It is very weird.
And what did you think about the two characters, Chris? Like, what do you think that their relationship is just as makes kind of the episode as bizarre as it is?
Yeah, look, I think, it's the film kind of embracing like an exaggerated version of unreality. Like, it kind of takes an unreal scenario and then pushes it to the extreme. So, yeah, Meatloaf's character was... one of the most vile, I think, in probably the whole anthology series. I'm trying to struggle with things. Probably, you know, at the top of the pile of the really ugly, offensive human beings that you see. And realistically, the female characters in Pelts as well weren't, they weren't represented in the greatest light either. Like, you could probably try and get a little bit pretentious and make allusions to how the relationship relates to, you know, consumerism of, you know, the fashion and things like that, but I wouldn't attempt to do that, would I?
Well, I think that's one of the things, another thing I liked about the film is like, why are these people just so obsessed about these raccoon pelts? But when you actually, what the film actually does quite well is they kind of use this subtle CGI to kind of give them this kind of shimmering kind of look to them.
I actually really, really liked that very subtle aspect. So when you look at those raccoons or the pelts, and by the way, before this episode, I didn't know that's what the animal skins like that were called. But anyway, you know, you can see like this little glimmering. It's very subtle, but you can see it. A little bit of glimmering and a little bit of motion, like it's there and you know there's something up with it. And I really, really liked that. That was a really good sort of just a very minor thing, but I think it paid off very well.
Yeah, the subtlety definitely helps because there have been some other Masters of Horror episodes where they've kind of gone heavy on the CGI, and because the budget's not there, it really kind of, yeah, it doesn't pass itself off that well. But when it is a lighter touch like this, it's really effective.
Oh, yeah. And also, like, it's... And you can definitely, like I said before, you can definitely see why these pelts kind of drive people like gaga over it, because you kind of see them and you're just kind of struck by just how beautiful they are. And, you know, I mean, raccoons are pretty cute animals and, you know, that just kind of adds to the little flavor of them. And but this is definitely like raccoons basically getting their revenge on human beings.
It was the origin story of Rocket Raccoon we didn't know existed.
Exactly. It explains everything.
So it was part of the MCU then. Fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. Exactly. But yeah, I mean, I think overall for me, it's funny though, like I was mixed on it before, but now talking about it, I kind of appreciate the episode a lot more. And I think, like I said, it is a mixed bag, but it is quite memorable. And I think it's kind of constant tonal shifts and it's sort of very dark humor. And the fact that it is so sleazy and gross and grimy and like not just in the visual style and the gore, but also the performances as well. And I agree, Marcy, like you can smell the sweat off Meatloaf in this episode. And it's very effective in that way. And it kind of does makes me appreciate the episode more. But I think in terms of, I guess, our ratings for this episode, I would give it a solid 3. Like, it's definitely not perfect. But I feel like Dario Argento and the cast kind of elevate the material and make it much more interesting than it probably could have been. But yeah, and it's also for me, I guess, definitely a stronger episode than Jennifer was. And Chris, what rating and final thoughts do you give for Pelts?
So for Pelts, I'd give it a really hearty 3.5 with an additional magic raccoon pelt to boot. yeah, I really enjoyed it. I felt quite gross throughout, and sometimes with horror, having that kind of feeling is what you're after. So I thought it ticked a lot of boxes for me. Really liked it.
And Marcy, what are your final thoughts on Pelts?
Yeah, look, for me, it is a mixed bag. And I do find that, you know, the stuff I liked, obviously, that I've mentioned, and stuff I didn't really like or didn't really connect with me, I think I did find it more interesting than Jennifer. So there is that. I would probably give it 2.5 out of 5,
mm-hmm.
which is up from my 2 when we watched it earlier.
So yeah, there definitely. You go. Yes.
Oh, see, there's my influence. Love it.
Yeah.
But we'll move right along from Pelts to the Screwfly solution.
In the garden, man lived in a state of innocence and bliss. Then woman arrived, temptress, and wrecked God's plan.
As of this afternoon, we have 1,100 homicides. All of them women.
Male sexual urges are very closely linked with aggression. Now, somehow, someone has figured out a way to erase the distinction. This is a concerted attempt to exterminate the human race.
Bioterror.
We have to begin the immediate evacuation of the female population.
Clear the aisle, everyone, please. Stay in your seats. I need everyone to remain calm.
Daddy, we missed you so much.
It's your daughter! It's Amy!
Well, what are you waiting for?
Which, of course, is the season 2 episode of Joe Dante, which of course, is it for all those out there who don't know who he is. He is the director of Gremlins 1 and 2, and as well as The Howling. And this episode, he reteams with his homecoming screenwriter, Sam Hamm, who, of course, wrote the original Batman film. And the episode was based on a short story by... I'm going to say all three because the author, Alice Sheldon, actually has two pseudonyms, which is like Racuna Sheldon and as well as, and James Tiptree Jr. So depending on which version of this episode you see, it's either one of those pseudonyms that she uses. And of course, the episode stars Jason Priestley, Kerry Norton, Brianna O'Brien, and Elliot Gould. And the plot summary for this one is: a nightmarish plague spreads across the globe, transforming men into killers who attack every woman that crosses their path. So, Marcy, this was your first time watching The Screwfly Solution. Tell us your thoughts on this episode.
Well, first of all, I was very disappointed this was not a sequel to The Peanut Butter Solution. So,
yes.
You know, it was going to be all downhill from there. No, I kid. But if you've listened to our episode on Homecoming, you know how much I really, really liked and enjoyed that episode. And I do, you know, for the most part, quite enjoy Joe Dante and his style. I definitely was looking forward to this one. Watching it, I'm just feeling like, was this made in 2020? Because this feels all too very familiar and relevant right now. Because, A, you have, like, a plague that is just spreading. It's highly contagious. You hear, like, you know, they made mention going, oh, it's bird flu. This town's going into quarantine. And I'm like, so we had, like, quarantines and shit last year and people whinged and moaned, but there was probably shit like that a little bit with the bloody other flus. And I'm just like, oh my God, people are dumb. But anyway, I digress. Whatever. definitely is feeling very, okay. But there's also a lot of, because this sort of plague is affecting men, and men are turning into this weird, like, Bible belt types who absolutely hate women. And again, we keep seeing a lot of this shit happening, and, you know, terms like incel have become very popular and the like. So I felt, you know, some of these themes and stuff just come across as, you know, still quite relevant. And I very much felt that with Homecoming. And I did sort of find that all very interesting. I thought it was a very engaging episode as well. And it is weird, like, you do wonder, like, what the fuck is going on? And, you know, if you pay attention closely at the beginning and they, you know, say quite a few things, which to me was very reminiscent of some of the conversations they had in, like, Jurassic Park about, you know, the things that men are doing, interfering with species and stuff like that. you know, I find that all very, very interesting. And yeah, I think, look, some of it, I wouldn't say it's not that it didn't work for me. I just don't know. Some of the flow of it just felt a little bit unbalanced, if that's the maybe the best way I can describe that. But I did find it still quite engaging and interesting. Bede.
Yeah, I actually really like this episode.
I'm kind of rambling, so I better just pass it over.
Well, but this episode for me, like, I remember when they sort of announced all the episodes for the second season, back when it was, when it was given an order, and they kind of had all the synopsises for all the episodes. And I got to admit, like, the Screwfly Solution, like, reading the synopsis for that, it was probably the one that intrigued me the most. And also with the name, the Screwfly Solution, I'm like, oh, that is such a weird title. What does it have anything to do with the actual plot? And just the idea of it as well was intriguing to me. And kind of watching the film, and it's interesting because, as we kind of all know with Joe Dante is one of those filmmakers who's kind of primarily known kind of doing more lighthearted, more humorous kind of films. Even if he is tackling like a horror film, it's always has, you know, comedy and all that in it. So I would say like The Screwfly Solution is probably the most serious film that he has tackled in his career. And this episode in particular is very dark and very bleak. It kind of does, maybe not on the same level as something like Imprint or like that, but in its own way, it really kind of pulls no punches in how it depicts like this kind of plague that causes men to be violent and aggressive towards women to the point of murdering them in very violent and confronting ways. And you see some really dark moments throughout this whole episode that I kind of forgotten like were there, and I was kind of taken aback by. And it is a film that it's very obviously that Joe Dante wanted to explore themes of misogyny and with this story. Because I know for a fact that Joe Dante actually read this story back in the 80s. And he loved it so much that he has been trying to make this story for film for years. But no studio wanted to touch it due to how dark and bleak it is. So, you know, he finally got the opportunity to do that with this episode of Masters of Horror. And I think it's still, like you say, it's a very engaging episode. Like, it's not perfect. Like, I think some of the performances are a bit shaky, with certain actors kind of working more than others. And I can definitely see your point about the flow of the episode, because it's kind of more almost like vignettes, because we're kind of seeing going through because we're following the story over the course of a few months. Like, you'll see one section happen, and then the next is like September, and then something happens and it goes into October. Like, it kind of, that sort of odd structure, like, does kind of hit the flow of the episode a little bit. But even then, I was still kind of found it engaging from beginning to end. And then when you kind of, the twist ending comes in at the end, like, it is incredibly out of left field. And at first you're like, what the fuck? But then when you kind of look back on the episode and reflect on it, it actually does make sense. Like, it's kind of like if this was a feature film, they kind of would have explored it a little bit more. But apparently it's just, that's the same even in the short story as well. It's like literally like one of the very last lines of the story. But at the same time though, like, I appreciate this episode in a lot of ways. And it's interesting because I was telling you earlier that this was the first episode of Masters. And I think it was the only one as well that was actually shot on digital. All the rest were shot on film, while this one was shot digitally. And of course, as we would see not long after this, a lot of TV shows would take that more digital route with their cameras and also visual style. So in a lot of ways, like, at times, like, the episode does look good, but other times it does look, makes it, the episode feel a little cheap in some regard. Like, then say, like, it probably wouldn't have if it was shot on film. But overall, I really do like this episode. It's not on the level as Homecoming, but I think it feels like the kind of, the other end of the, like, the yin to Homecoming's yang. While that was more of a satirical comedy about politics. This is sort of a more darker, kind of bleak story about violence and misogyny, and also sexism as well. But yeah, those are my ramblings. But Chris, what are your thoughts on the Screwfly solution?
No worries. So I can certainly ramble. Although I will say, each of you, did absolutely hit on points that struck home to me. So I think first off, you mentioned the digital filmmaking here. Mm. That was an issue for me. I talked about pelts and imprints, really cinematic style. Here, the digital footage and, you know, the handheld. I know that Joe Dante was trying to go for a particular aesthetic, but the thing is with early digital stuff, like it looks trash to be honest. You know, you see that in a lot of the older films and documentaries when digital was coming to the fore. Mm. They had this real kind of home video look. So that was an issue for me, but Joe Dante's two contributions to the Masters of Horror were both, I think, conceptually the most interesting. The first, obviously, really political. And it interested me that Joe Dante said that the Screwfly solution, you know, wasn't really meant to be political, and maybe not in the sense of Homecoming. It wasn't that type of political, but it was absolutely sociopolitical for me. Like, I think whether he liked it or not, it was a really provocative and confrontational look at a real life epidemic, which is that of, you know, domestic violence against women. That's something which, you know, is really raw subject to kind of confront in society. And I really liked the fact that the film did that. Like, essentially, it showcased what it actually is. It's pure violence. It's rage. It's horrific and it's horrifying.
Yeah.
So I was surprised by how bleak and dark it was in that respect. But I think sometimes that's what horror is good at. You can look at real life horrors through a different type of lens to kind of confront those things and really think about them and figure out, yeah, how do we fix that part of our society that's really fucked up. So I really respected that aspect to it. I also have some of the similar issues in terms of like the pacing and things like that didn't quite work for me. So at the end of the day, I think it was a really interesting and provocative subject that kind of didn't have the execution to really lift it up to a top tier level for me.
This is probably something that I think, and we often do sort of bring this up, if the individual episodes would work as feature length films. And I think this one, it definitely would. And I think that would, you know, given, you know, the right budget, that it would work really, really well as a feature film.
Absolutely.
And you can definitely explore a lot more of the themes, and especially what happens towards the end, a bit more. And it's definitely one that, yeah, I think would really work as a feature. And just going back to pelts, I'm not entirely sure that would have, but I think I think the difference with pelts and the Screwfly solution is that pelts already sort of had that kind of cinematic feel. And I think that is, you know, where some of the like little issues with this, it felt way too TV like, and it could be because it was filmed digitally and it was still very, you know, earlier days, so it doesn't look and feel as good. This felt very, you know, very, very TV-ish, and I think it kind of suffers a little bit from that. But I do think it is a very solid and fine episode of Masters of Horror. And after thinking on it more, especially with the ending, you know, I just felt like, you know, at first I was like, what the fuck is this? This is silly. But then, you know, as I thought on it more, I'm like, actually makes a lot of sense in the way that you go back to the beginning and they do make mention of, you know, you're basically destroying, like, even if it's a species of fly, but you're basically destroying something over time. And as we find out, obviously the show is, you know, spoilers, which we have the disclaimer. It is aliens who are basically pretty much doing what the humans are doing to the other species. They're like, we're coming to basically wipe you out by doing this and, you know, we'll take what we want. And the allusions to, like, the men seeing angels, when you see the aliens, they do have that kind of weird mystical look to them, which is sort of interesting.
And that was kind of the thing I find interesting, like, in terms of, because basically whatever this virus that these aliens unleashed on the planet, like, it basically has the men kill off all women. And then eventually it kind of hints at that now, since there's no women, they are also killing off male children who are kind of less masculine than, you know, full-on men and all that. So, and to the point where basically, like, if you're going to destroy a species, like, you pretty much either kill off all the males or kill off all the females, and then that way there's no breeding, and then it just, the species just slowly dies off over time. And I do find it interesting that the aliens themselves, like you said, they did, because throughout the episode there is, like, at the beginning, like, you, when you see all these kind of violent men at the streets, they kind of form this kind of religious cult called Sons of Adam. And that a lot of the members say, oh, like, what they're doing is, like, they're kind of doing this because an angel told them to. And like you said, the aliens have this kind of angelic look to them. But at the same time, though, I found that interesting is, like, on a sort of how they're designed, they also have this kind of feminine look to them as well, because they almost have, like, almost like long flowing hair, and which I found kind of interesting in that regard. I'm not sure how you guys feel about that.
Oh, we're all silent. Yeah, I agree with you. They did sort of feel like that.
Yeah, I hadn't really put that much thought into that aspect of it, to be honest. I was actually thinking in this discussion, yeah, I got lost in my own train of thought. There's my dog in the background. it was about that political aspect and whether, like I said, whether or not Joe Dante wanted it to be political, it was at least socio-political. I was imagining, like, how the tone would be different, how my reception to the film would have been different if the gender roles were reversed. So if it was the women that were killing off the men, like, it would actually be an entirely different type of picture, because you don't have that kind of view of, you know, the real life unfortunate fact that, you know, women are dying at the hands of men at a you know, far too significant rate. Whereas if the roles were reversed, you wouldn't have that equation to make. So yeah, it definitely plays kind of with gender roles a little bit, I thought, yeah, and in those depictions. Yeah, it's a bit of food for thought for me.
I find it interesting that, you know, the way to avoid, like, what's happening for the men is to have a chemical castration or an actual castration. And, you know, the feeling is, and with the lead character, like, played by Jason Priestley, he refuses to do it, whereas Elliot Gould's character says, no, I've had the chemical castration. So, you know, there's the two different kind of things. And I think I said to B, like, after she said the alternate being actual castration, I'm like, can they just do that for most of them? You only need, like, a few left to, you know, keep the world going.
Keep them chained up.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if anyone knows me, I am definitely a feminist, and I'm just going to say there are some men in the world who probably need an actual castration and fed their balls because they're that terrible. So,
that's true.
I wouldn't disagree with you there.
Even though as dark and bleak as this, I would think, Marcy, if you were in this episode, you'd be like, we're going to stand back and fight against the men, and then you'd be like kicking ass left and right. So,
oh no, I'd have like the big Why can't I think of what things are called? You know, like the hedge trimmers, but it'll be
yes
for the testes. But yeah, although I do want to say, if anybody is listening and you do find yourself in a situation that deals with abuse, please reach out to the relevant people, and you should not have to suffer in silence.
Definitely, without a doubt.
That was my serious tone, and I just thought, you know, considering this is the subject, and it can be very, you know, can bring up a lot of emotions and feelings for people, but if, you know, anyone is in that situation, wherever you are in the world, just find that correct phone number you need to find and make that call.
Yeah, definitely. And I think with for our listeners, like as much as I do recommend this episode,
testicles.
Yes. But yes. But even as much as I do recommend this episode, I will say, like, I would definitely put a trigger warning on this episode, because in some scenes where it does have men being very violent towards some of the female characters, it is very confronting and unflinching. And I feel like that is the purpose of what Joe Dante was doing, just to show that and for us to be, as an audience, being absolutely disgusted, repulsed and horrified of it, as it should be. But at the same time, though, I think that for a lot of people out there, those kind of scenes would be very triggering. So I would definitely, if you do watch this episode, definitely proceed with caution on that front.
Yeah, I find that this is such an interesting topic around, like, yeah, sensitive material like this, because I try and identify, like, who the audience is when the subject matter is of this. And as a male looking at it, like, I think it is speaking directly to me. Like, I would hesitate to say, you know, that females need to watch this because of, you know, their lived in experience. But as a male, like, I kind of need to confront, you know, a reality in terms of society and what's happening out there. So, yeah, it's hard to recommend to watch it, but it's a very important topic and something we do need to take very seriously.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think even when Marcy and I were watching this episode, usually Marcy and I will come and kind of do commentate on some of the episodes, like throw a joke here and there. But I think you and I, Marcy, were basically just quiet for about 90-95% of it.
Yeah, like, we're just sitting there kind of taking it all in. And you know, there were a few little, you know, Jason Priestley jokes, because, you know, he was on 90210. But you know, I do credit him for you know, it was kind of in a way like typecast into that kind of character from 90210. And after he sort of wrapped up that show, he was trying to take, like, different roles. And I appreciate that he, you know, took on something like this and, you know, he felt like it was more than a one-dimensional character or a one-note character, which I definitely agree with. And, you know, for him, like, it is good to see him pop up in this and, you know, take on a difficult role, because there are scenes with his character where he has been infected that are very, you know, messed up.
Oh, definitely. And I would say, like, if anything, like, even though, yeah, it's Jason Priestley and Elliot Gould are kind of the two headliners of this episode, it really, this episode belongs to Kerry Norton, who I thought was really solid.
She's really, really good in it.
Yeah, as Jason Priestley's character's wife, Anne. And I will say this, though, even though I do like her performance, I felt that the Brianna O'Brien, who played their daughter, Amy, that character just did not work for me. And her performance wasn't that great either.
I feel like the character of Amy was written with basically an 8-year-old in mind, but they cast, like, you know, someone who was like 16, but she still acts like she's 8.
Yeah.
And that kind of really bothered me. And that character makes really, really bad, stupid decisions. And I didn't like that. Like, you have Anne, who, you know, sort of doesn't all together understand quite what's going on or how far things have advanced with this thing, but she still has her smarts about her, and she's able to make decisions that are going to protect herself and her daughter. But her daughter is just like really just not on the level.
And oh, yeah.
You feel like that character should have been old enough to know better. And I don't like saying that about anyone because it can be rude.
Yeah.
But when it feels like the character was written with like an 8-year-old in mind, it is very problematic for me.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
When the character still acts that way. And again, I know we bring this movie up like all the frickin' time. But, you know, again, it is a problem that I had with The Fanatic, where the character of Moose is a grown man, and he does have, you know, the character is meant to be autistic, but the way it is portrayed, and I feel like the way it was probably written, is like he is a 5-year-old child, and that does not fucking work. That's not how it works at all. And it's kind of the same issue here, where that character is not how it feels like they were written. Sorry, that's just my bloody rant about that.
and I do agree, because like every decision her character makes is kind of frustrating and aggravating, because like, why are you acting like this? You're 16. I mean, yes, you're 16 years old, and yeah, you're a teenager, you may be a bit rebellious, but just grow up and stop acting this way. And you know, but then again, as we have seen over the past year, in a pandemic, some people act more like children, full grown-ups act more like children, so...
I think one of the biggest giveaways that this character probably was written for someone much younger is that she still calls him Daddy, and she runs off seeing his car going, Daddy, 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 and I'm like, yeah, an 8-year-old would do that, not like a 16-year-old.
Well, that is a good point. That is a good point.
Do you think that some of this, I guess, reimagining of the age of the character might have had something to do with maybe some concerns around, because there was some, you know, father-daughter kind of inappropriate, you know.
And I feel like, I was going to say, like, I think they probably had to age the character up because... the father does turn with this disease. He does get infected, and you see him, you know, do something very not okay to his daughter, which you don't see much of because he doesn't have much of a chance. But yeah, I think probably because of that is why it was aged up in terms of casting, but they didn't really rewrite the character to fit the age that they're meant to be. I think there's an interesting element as well to this, is that the sort of disease, or whatever you want to call it, the plague, that aggression is linked to sexual arousal. So when he attacks his daughter in that way, is that trying to say something? Or, you know, you sort of see like the babies have been killed at the hospital. Is that trying to say something about, you know, it's very, very sort of confronting when you look into it so much more. And there is definitely that, you know, I guess parallel in a way with the religious aspect and obviously the sexual abuse that happens within the church. So maybe I'm reading too much into it.
Yeah.
I don't know. This whole conversation is very serious, and it's foreign to me because we are always very silly, but we do tackle the serious subjects.
Yeah, and I think like, and also it doesn't help like she is kind of unlikable from the very beginning when we meet her, because they're watching like a news report about I think it was 150 Muslim women were killed. And then she makes a derogatory term about Muslim people. So
that did not sit well with me at all.
It definitely did not. And then, of course, she does weird things, like when her parents are having sex in the room, she like legit rings up one of her friends. It's like, my parents are having sex.
Yeah, that was weird. And just what?
Oh, you guys never did that? Okay.
No, because I really never wanted to hear my parents be doing that. Believe me, if I had an inkling something was happening, that volume was going up on the stereo.
Or I'd just run out the door right away.
I don't know. It's very, very weird. But, Chris, I feel like me and Bede have done way too much talking. If you have anything else to add, please do.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think it's been a good conversation. And I think I'm fairly, set in my stance on it. I think really important topic. And I thought it was kind of the tone was right and everything like that. It was just on an aesthetic level. It fell over a little bit for me. So, that's where I'm at with this one.
Yeah, and I gotta say, I even though he wasn't in it a lot, I actually really liked Elliot Gould in this.
True, I thought he was great. Yeah,
yeah, he's really great, and I really liked his character a lot. And he was the smartest one in the whole movie.
He really was. He was a smart man.
Indeed, because he's Elliot Gould. But Marcy, what rating do you give the Screwfly Solution?
This is a difficult one, because as much as I like it and certain things, there are other aspects that kind of did bring it down a little bit. But I think, I'm sitting on 3.5 out of 5 for it.
Hmm.
If you're listening and you haven't watched it, it is something you definitely need some kind of a warning, because it is very confrontational. It has a very, very serious kind of themes in it. And again, it's still very freaking relevant to today. So, and it is very different tonally from what you might be used to with Joe Dante. That's mine.
Chris, what rating do you and your final thoughts on the Screwfly Solution?
Sure. Yeah. So, with that, I think it's diametrically opposed tonally to the first episode we discussed, Pelts. So that my biggest takeaway from that back to back was it went from this really hysterical kind of over the top, like you mentioned, almost a parody type horror into something that was quite thoughtful and uncomfortable and confrontational. And maybe some of my hesitancy around it is kind of based on that, just this kind of whiplash that I experienced. So where I landed, I'd give it a straight down the line 2.5. I think there are some really great aspects to this, and equally I thought there were the components that did undercut it a little bit, did it enough for me to not go overboard and completely be positive on it.
I would say 3.5 as well. I think the episode definitely has a bit more flaws in it than compared to Homecoming, which I think for me, at least for me personally, is an almost perfect episode. I think some of the performances are a bit shaky. So the flow of it is a bit uneven, but I think in terms of what Joe Dante set out to do was make this kind of very, very serious sort of sci-fi horror film that tackles these still very timely themes in a way that is very confronting and unflinching. I got to give him a lot of credit. And you wouldn't expect the director of films like Explorers and Into Space to make something like this. And I do like it when a filmmaker actually, gets out of the box and does something different. So I give him a lot of kudos for that. And of course, for its out of place ending that just, again, which I can definitely understand a lot of people hating because it does come out of nowhere. But again, when you kind of think about it, it does make sense as you kind of reflect back on the episode. And again, I think it's also one of those episodes that if you just replay, if this episode never came out in 2006 and came out today, I think it would still work incredibly well, just due to the subject matter and also its approach to the story. Although I have found out recently that the new Twilight Zone has an episode that has a very similar premise to this one in one of their episodes. So I don't know if that's another adaptation of this story or it's just an original that has similar ideas and themes, so we may have to come find out on a future episode of Podcast of the Horror down the track, but we shall see. But overall, though, yeah, 3.5 for me overall. But yeah, that's our the end of our 10th episode of Podcasters of Horror, and thank you again, once again, Marcy, for being an awesome co-host, and
of course,
and also Chris for coming back on the show again and talking these episodes with us.
And thank you so much, guys, for having me. You're always generous hosts. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
We do our best, that's for sure.
Yes, but Chris, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Sure. Well, usually they can find me at DJ_Kaiser on any social media that I have. So Twitter, Letterboxd, that's what I go by pretty consistently. And I don't do a whole heap more else than that. I haven't written for Cinema, etc. for a while, but check it out for any new reviews and updates as well.
Although I did enjoy the last column you wrote for the website, which was like, what was it, your top five films that you didn't see in 2020?
Yeah, so that spoke to, I think we were talking beforehand about, you know, backlogs in movies. I didn't watch many movies in 2020, not new ones anyway. So when we were all doing our end of year lists, I chose five films that I didn't see, which was an interesting exercise.
Indeed. But however, that being said, I still can't forgive you for Color Out of Space. That's just...
How dare you?
I was waiting for it.
I was going to wait, leave it to the very end. But
we still love you, but barely.
No. Well, yeah. I may be a little less for me, but that's a whole different story. But
what I will say is that film is always mulling over my head, the ending. Like, I think the ending was simply astonishing. So, you know, it's either an absolute debacle or it's kind of like a crackpot genius, and I'm flitting between both all the time.
It's the movie version of Pelts, let's just say that. But Marcy, where can people find you on the internet this week?
You can find me, or you can definitely find all of our stuff, at supermarcy.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/supermarcy, or you can find me on Twitter at my art page. And I've totally forgotten what it is, so just give me like 2 seconds to remember it. you can edit this part out. You can find me on my art Twitter at twitter.com/theartofmp1. You can also find us at The Super Network on Facebook. So it's just facebook.com/The Super Network. You can join us on our Facebook group, which is, if you type in The Super Network group on Facebook, you'll find us, where you can post memes, post reviews, share podcasts, participate in polls, and vote on our monthly fan-voted commentaries. You can find The Super Network on Twitter at @SM_SuperNetwork. You can email us at thesupernetworksm@gmail.com. You can just subscribe to us on Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork, or you can subscribe to my personal Patreon for my artwork, which is only $1 for naughty drawings, and that is patreon.com/theartofmp. And you can subscribe to Podcasters of Horror, or The Super Network, or The King Zone, or any of our other podcasts, as we are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, CastBox, Deezer, Pocket Casts, and Podcast Addict feed.
But well, people want to find me on the internet, they can always find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BJMI, where you can hear my daily ramblings about movies and life in general. And of course, when I just use my picture from Millionaire Hot Seat as a meme, whatever I just choose to. But you can also find my writings over at supermarcy.com with my reviews and columns. My new upcoming edition of Bad Movie Tweet-a-thon is coming. It is a bit late, mainly because, again, I've had family visiting, so I haven't had time to do it, which, but I will very soon. And of course, it will be on the Glenn Danzig horror film, Veronica, which just happens to also be an anthology horror film, Marcy, so we may have to do an episode on it for podcasters of horror in the future. But keep a lookout for that. And of course, you can find my official writers page on Facebook at facebook.com/terribleaussie. And of course, everyone sign up for our Patreon and get some really awesome and cool exclusives. And also go to our YouTube channel and check out snippets from all of our podcasts, and as well as full episodes of Podcasters of Horror as well.
And I totally forgot to plug that before. So thank you, Ed.
Yes. But yeah, I hope all of our listeners enjoyed this long-awaited new episode of Podcasters of Horror. We hope you all enjoyed it. And we will be back with episode 11 very soon, in which we will be talking about episodes 8 and 9 of season 2, which are Mick Garris's Valerie on the Stairs and Rob Schmidt's Right to Die. So keep a lookout for that one, and we'll see you all then. See you, everybody. Thank you. Bye.